outside on the street and walked between the stone pillars. In all the years his mother had worked at the shirt factory, he'd never passed beyond the arch, a fact that now seemed astonishing. After Grace's death, of course, there'd been no reason to come. But as he entered the courtyard, he couldn't help feeling that he was finally attending to some long-ignored obligation. The white limo was still parked there, and on the other side of the brick wall sat Mrs. Whiting's Lincoln, invisible from the street. Motionless on the shelf behind the back seat was what Miles thought at first glance must be one of those mechanical animals that nodded rhythmic agreement when the vehicle was in motion. But he then realized it was Timmy the cat. The animal was regarding him curiously, marking his progress along the courtyard, and smiling, it seemed, if cats other than the Cheshire variety can be said to smile. When he heard a car door open, Miles saw that the flash of red he'd noticed earlier was Jimmy Minty's Camaro, which had been blocked from view by the limo. Mrs. Whiting and the limo men had made their way from the shirt factory down to the adjacent textile mill that overlooked the falls. The group was clustered just outside the main entrance, sighting along Mrs. Whiting's extended arm, first looking up at the old building, then out across the river. What was she pointing out? Her own house a quarter mile upstream? Was that too for sale? At the end of the courtyard, a brick walkway led around the shirt factory and down the slope to the mill, and it was here that Jimmy Minty had planted himself. "You're on private property, Miles," he said. "I thought all this belonged to the town." "We won't argue," Jimmy Minty shrugged. "It's posted anyhow." He wasn't wearing the plaid sports coat he usually wore while on duty. Still, Miles thought he'd check. "Who am I talking to here, Jimmy?"
"Come again?"
They were face to face now. "Are you on duty?"
"Sort of. I do a little private consulting."
"Like your father used to?"
He nodded. "Old Mr. Honus Whiting hired my dad now and then. I saw him beat the tar out of a fellow one night not far from where we're standing. I was the only witness, in fact. Stubborn little fucker. It was a beating he could have avoided."
"How about your mother? Could her beatings have been avoided?" Minty took a moment before answering.
"No," he said sadly. "I don't think so. You all probably heard a lot of that over in your house, huh?
We should have called the cops."
This seemed to stimulate a memory. "I ever tell you about the time your mom came over? You must not have been there. Hot summer afternoon, all the windows open. My old man was going to town on Ma, like he did sometimes when she pissed him off. Then all of a sudden he turned around and there was your mother, standing right in the middle of our living room, like she paid rent. Told my old man he was going to stop what he was doing right this instant, and wasn't ever going to start up again. Right this instant, her exact words. She had a hammer in her hand, turned around so the claw end faced the front."
Miles had no trouble conjuring up the scene. Right this instant had been one of her pet phrases. He'd only seen Grace mad once or twice, but he could imagine her there with the hammer, and could also imagine William Minty backing up a step when he saw her.
"Hard to say what would have happened if Ma hadn't spoke up," Jimmy chuckled. "She's sitting there on the floor with a busted lip. Takes one look at your mother standing there with that hammer and tells her to go fuck herself and mind her own business. See, your mom, being so pretty, was what my mom feared most, even more than my old man." He paused. "She never told you about that day, huh?"
"Not a word." He shrugged.
"Ah, fuck the past, right?"
And when Miles offered no opinion on whether this was either possible or advisable, his eyes narrowed.
"My boy Zach's thinking about quitting the football team, do you know that? I keep trying to talk him out of it, but I don't know. Coach won't play him no more, so maybe he's right. What's the point? All that shit in the newspaper about him being a dirty player. I guess everybody figures he's a bad kid. Your friend, the principal's trying to blame him for what happened to that old woman they found."
Miles had no desire to hear any of this. "I'm here to see Mrs. Whiting, Jimmy. It won't take long." The other man seemed almost grateful for the change of subject.
She said for me to tell you tomorrow.
She knew I was coming?
There ain't much that lady doesn't know, Miles. Several steps ahead of people like you and me. She's kind of disappointed in you, is my impression.
I'm sure she'll tell me all about it, Miles said, and started around the policeman, who grabbed him by the left elbow.
Except not today.
When Miles hit him as hard as he could, Jimmy Minty held on to his elbow for balance, but finally had to let go and sit down on the curb that bordered the walkway. His nose was broken, that much Miles could tell. It took the blood a moment to start, then it began to flow freely, soaking the front of his white shirt. Miles could see from where he stood that Timmy was racing frantically around inside the Lincoln, from window to window, as if she had a fat wager on the outcome of these hostilities. Down at the mill, Mrs. Whiting and the limo men had gone inside. Miles stood over Minty, unsure what was supposed to happen next. The policeman was leaning back on both hands now and staring up at the gray sky, probably in the hope that his blood wouldn't flow uphill. He sniffed four or five times, then sneezed mightily, dappling both Miles and himself.
"Well, how about that?" he said. "Old Miles Roby committing a violent act. Won't people be surprised?"
Miles stared down at him, recalling his father's advice about cops. The worst they could do to you wasn't that bad. Miles found it more than a little disconcerting to be following his father's counsel in an important matter, but he was still a very long way from regret, which he had a feeling there'd be plenty of time for later on. After a minute, the worst of the nosebleed having stopped, Jimmy Minty got to his feet. He was wobbly, but also, Miles saw, determined.
"Come on over to the car," he said. "Let me put the cuffs on you."
"Not until I've talked to Mrs. Whiting.
I have my orders."
"Well?" Minty drove his fist into Miles' midsection, doubling him over. Another punch he didn't even see dropped him to one knee. He was still trying to get his breath back when Jimmy hit him behind the left ear, setting off an explosion in his skull. He slumped onto the brick path then, and when no further blows followed, he rolled over and saw that Minty had returned to the Camaro and was rooting around in the glove box, which suggested to Miles that he must have blacked out, at least for a few seconds. By the time the policeman had located the handcuffs, Miles had managed to get back to his feet.
"You'd do better to just set back down, Miles," Minty advised. His nose was swelling and turning gray. "You created your disturbance, and now I've quelled it."
It occurred to Miles that despite his broken nose, this was a richly rewarding experience for Jimmy Minty. He easily slipped the next punch Miles flung, and then Miles was back on his knees, cradling his stomach, retching onto the bricks.
"Now straighten up and put out your wrists," Minty said.
But instead, twice more, Miles struggled to his feet, and twice more found himself back on the ground. By the time Mrs. Whiting and the limo men returned up the walkway, one of Miles's eyes was completely closed, the other a mere slit. Both men were seated, facing each other, on opposite curbs, looking like they'd been on the same losing side of a fight, the victors having unaccountably run away. The handcuffs still dangled from the policeman's fingers, and Miles could tell it embarrassed him.
"You go on along, Mrs. Whiting," Minty said. His breathing sounded strangled. "I'll finish up with this after I've caught my breath."
The businessmen, clearly nervous, gave the two locals a wide berth, walking well off the brick path onto the grass to circle around them.
"You amaze me, dear boy," said Mrs. Whiting. "What was so important that it couldn't wait until tomorrow?"
Across the courtyard, Miles could hear the limo's doors open and close, the solid, well-made sound of money sealing itself off. Since she was probably expecting him to say something about Callahan's, he decided to disappoint her.
"I just came by to give you my notice," he told her. "You'll have to find someone else to run the Empire Grill."
Jimmy Minty quit fingering his broken nose to listen to this.
"You appear to have been visited by some sort of revelation, dear boy," Mrs. Whiting observed. "Here's my suggestion, though. Why not think things over? Passionate decisions are seldom very sound. When did you ever feel passion?" Well, it's true, I'm seldom swept away like those with more romantic temperaments, she conceded. But we are what we are, and what can't be cured must be endured.
What can't be cured must be avenged, Miles said. Isn't that what you mean?
She smiled appreciatively. Payback is how we endure, dear boy. Now, before you say another word in anger for which I should have to punish you, you'll want to stop and consider not just your own future, but your daughter's. She may require assistance with her university expenses in a couple of years, much as you did.
She paused to let this sink in. And, of course, there are your brother and the others who depend upon the Empire Grill for their admittedly slender livelihoods. In the end, though, it's up to you, just as it always has been.
Power and control, right, Francine?
It was the first time he had ever called her by her first name. In fact, over the years, he'd nearly forgotten it. Strange that it should return to him at this moment. If being addressed so intimately offended Mrs. Whiting, she took pains to conceal it.
Ah, she said in mock delight. You were paying attention to my little lessons, weren't you, dear boy? I could never be sure.
And with that, she turned and stepped nimbly around and toward the Lincoln.
He preferred my mother, didn't he, Mrs. Whiting? Miles called after her. That's what all this is about, right?
She stopped, stock still for a moment, then returned to where he sat.
And am I not a model of Christian forbearance, dear boy? Did I not forgive your mother her trespass? Did I not welcome her into the very home she destroyed? Did I not offer her every opportunity for the expiation and redemption you Catholics are forever going on and on about.
Redemption? Wasn't it really retribution?
Well, as I once explained to my husband, there was a little something in the relationship for each of us.
She started away again, then stopped and turned back.
Having said that, I wouldn't want to leave you with the wrong impression, dear boy. I was very fond of your mother, just as I'm very fond of you. In the end, I think she was glad things didn't work out quite as she'd hoped. I like to think she came to understand life's great folly.
Then she looked down at the policeman.
Do you think you can manage to lock up Jimmy? The padlock on that gate is a little stiff. It requires no end of coaxing.
I'll take care of it, Mrs. Whiting.
Miles couldn't help but smile. Having made more or less the same promise to the woman for 25 years... the precise destiny his mother had feared above all others. When the Lincoln glided out between the stone pillars, followed by the limo, Miles felt something rub against his elbow. And when he looked down, there was Timmy, who must have escaped when Mrs. Whiting opened the car door. The animal seemed satisfied with the damage already inflicted on Miles and offered no additional malice. Jimmy Minty got to his feet and offered Miles a hand, which Miles accepted, and then held out his wrist to be cuffed. Jimmy led him over to the Camaro, kicking the cat out of the way, hard, when she tried to follow. Miles tried without luck to remember the last time he'd been in a sports car. The engine growled like a caged animal directly beneath his feet. Charlene had once confessed that she considered this a sexy sound. Human folly indeed. Outside the gate, Minty put the Camaro in park and went back to close and lock the gate. As Mrs. Whiting had predicted, this was not an easy job, and Miles could hear him swearing at the lock.
"You never should have come back here, old buddy," Jimmy Minty said when he got back in the car. "Your mother was right about that. I'll never forget how she screamed at you. I guess that's what I was trying to say before all this started."
By all this, he seemed to mean everything that had happened since he'd found Miles parked outside his boyhood home back in September. "I felt real bad when I heard her screaming at you like that. All those things she said when she was dying. And you just trying to help."
Miles closed his eyes and listened to her, the memory still fresh, horrible.
"Go away, Miles. You're killing me. Can't you understand that? Your being here is killing me. Killing me."
"Not that you cared if I felt bad or not," he added.
"Do me a favor, Jimmy," Miles asked, when he eased the Camaro out onto Empire Avenue.
Sure. He seemed anxious to demonstrate that despite being habitually and cruelly misused, he wasn't the sort of man to withhold a favor if asked nicely. Ask my brother to make sure Tick gets down to Boston on Sunday. His promise to his daughter was the thing he'd forgotten, the thing that, had he remembered it, might have kept him from heading down this very wrong road. He remembered thinking a few minutes earlier that there'd be plenty of time for regret later. How quickly later had arrived. Chapter 30. The blue table has the blues. Is it even remotely possible, Tick wonders, that this is somehow due to the continued absence of John Voss, who'd been more absent than present back when he was still sitting there? Even Candace, who usually could be counted on to talk from one bell to the next, is quiet today. What Tick's trying to fathom is not the girl's silence, which she understands, but how things work. More specifically, whether they happen fast or slow. She knows from recent experience that the whole world can change in what feels like an instant, but she suspects that the swiftness is really just an illusion. Take Candace, for instance. Did they become friends yesterday, or has their friendship been growing since September? Clearly, it's caught both of them off guard. The expression on Candace's face yesterday afternoon, a mixture of gratitude and disbelief, was vivid testimony to how surprised she was to see a swollen-eyed Tick on her doorstep. For the last month, she'd been suggesting that Tick stop by some afternoon after school so they could take a walk along the river, but her offhanded manner implied that she didn't really expect this to happen. Tick had no trouble finding where Candace lived with her mother and her mother's boyfriend of the moment, a three-story building on Front Street. Front ran parallel to the river, below the falls, the worst neighborhood of Empire Falls, settled by the poorest of the French-Canadian immigrants back when it was a company town. Houses had been built only on the north side of the street, and for good reason. In the glory days of Empire Textile, the solvents and dyes used on the fabrics were dumped directly into the river, staining the banks below the falls red and green and yellow, according to day of the week and size of the batch. The sloping banks contained rings, like those in a tree trunk, except these were in rainbow colors. They recorded not years, but the rise and fall of the river. Even now, 50 years later, only the hardiest weeds and scrub trees grew south of the pavement on Front Street, and when the brush was periodically cleared, surprising patches of fading chartreuse and magenta were revealed. The apartment was on the second floor, its entryway at the top of a rickety exterior staircase. The woman who answered Tick's knock was big and braless and dirty-haired and didn't look old enough to have a 16-year-old daughter. When she pulled the door open, Tick felt a blast of unhealthy heat and saw a man who looked about her father's age, wearing a fishnet tank top and seated at a dinette, concentrating grimly on the flyer from the Fairhaven Walmart. "Hey, moron!" the woman called over her shoulder, without bothering to say hello to Tick. "Candy, you got company!" Then she walked away from the open door, leaving Tick to either come in or not, as suited her. To remain outside suited her best. The sight of this awful woman had the effect of putting Tick's recent argument with her own mother into a whole different perspective. When Candace saw her from the kitchen doorway, her face lit up, and then darkened with perplexed embarrassment at the presence of a girl like Christina Roby in their shabby neighborhood. The last time she'd been this surprised was back in September, when the same girl took up residence in art class with herself and the other boners. "Hi," she offered apologetically. "Could we maybe take that walk?" Tick said. "Sure." Candace's face quickly brightened again, as if at the opportunity of a lifetime. "Anyway," Candace said, after they'd climbed down the bank, "I'm in love with Justin now." At the end of a dry October, the river was running low, and they were able to leap from rock to rock pretty far out into the current. From shore, it had seemed like they might be able to hopscotch all the way to the opposite bank, but Tick now saw that the farther out into the river they got, the farther apart the rocks actually were.
The wind was also more bitter away from the sheltered bank, so they changed direction and headed downstream toward the bend. There the indented shoreline would provide a windbreak.
"Justin," Tick repeated, when they found a couple big rocks to rest on. She couldn't help smiling at the idea of Candace and Justin Dibble, who'd spent most of the term tormenting her by describing the monster crush he claimed John Voss had on her. She also suspected that Candace didn't realize that by flitting, emotionally if not physically, from boy to boy, she was imitating her mother.
"He really loves me," she explained, as if the boy's feelings for her were the deciding factor, as opposed to her feelings for him.
"What about Zach?"
"There'll probably be a fight when he gets out of the hospital," Candace admitted fatalistically.
Strange, but fights over Candace appeared to be backing up. Earlier in the week, Bobby, the girl's former boyfriend from Fairhaven, who Candace claimed had been in jail, showed up at the high school just off school grounds, looking for Zach Minty, whom he didn't know on sight. Unaware that the boy, whose ass he'd come to kick, had been admitted to the hospital that morning with an infected gash on his shin. For some reason, he'd waited a long time to have the injury looked at, claiming he didn't even remember how he'd got it, but speculating it must have happened at football practice. It hadn't looked like a football injury to the emergency room physician, who immediately put him on antibiotics. For a long time, Zach's fever had refused to come down, and yesterday the doctors still wanted to keep him under observation, though they'd promised both him and his father that unless his fever spiked again, they'd release him on Friday and wouldn't stand between him and playing on Saturday, the last home game of the season.
"Do you think Justin would stand a chance?" Candace wondered idly, as if this were a conundrum on the magnitude of Superman versus the Incredible Hulk.
"Against Zach or Bobby?" Tick asked, though it made no difference since Justin stood no chance against either.
"Zach," Candace clarified. "I don't think Bobby would fight Justin. He just wanted to get it on with Zach because he heard Zach's tough."
Even sheltered from the worst of the wind, it was still cold, and getting dark, too, though it wasn't yet 4 o'clock. Still, coming here had been a good idea. Tick could feel her spirits gradually picking up. Her shoulder still hurt from being dragged down by her backpack, but what happened had frightened more than injured her. And as was often the case, talking to Candace buoyed her spirits, though she did wonder if the mere fact that somebody was worse off than you was a proper basis for friendship. Both girls were silent for a while, listening to the water slide by at their feet.
"When you and Zach were together," Candace finally said, "did you ever play the gun game?"
Tick studied Candace's expression and saw the fear in her eyes.
"Once," she admitted. "He said you used to play it all the time. He was trying to get me to."
Zach called it Polish roulette, which was supposed to be a joke. He'd broken one of his father's revolvers open and shown Tick there were no bullets in the cylinder. Then you were supposed to put the barrel of the gun against your head and pull the trigger. The idea, as he explained it to Tick, was to see how rational you were. If you knew by the evidence of your own senses that the gun wasn't loaded, then you had nothing to fear. Except it was still a gun, and your mind couldn't forget that.
"It's a rush, though," he admitted, grinning at her. "'Cause, like, what if you were wrong and there was one bullet in there you missed?"
"Don't you hate it when you find out people are lying to you?" Candace said, apparently referring to Zach's claim that he and Tick had played the game all the time.
"Candace," Tick said, "promise me you'll never do it."
"Okay."
She shrugged, her fear apparently evaporating the instant she shared the story with her friend.
"No, I mean it," Tick said. "Promise me right now or we're not friends anymore."
"Okay, okay," Candace said, more seriously now. Then,
"We're friends? I can tell people we're friends?"
"Sure, why not?" Seeing how badly Candace wanted that made Tick wonder whether it would have made a difference if she'd told John Voss the same thing. What if all everybody needed in the world was to be sure of one friend? What if you were the one,
and you refused to say those simple words. It was nearly dark now, and when they started back toward the riverbank, a movement on the shore attracted their attention. About 50 yards upstream, right where the river began to bend toward Empire Falls, stood a group of men in suits, huddled and shivering, but attentive. They seemed to be listening to a woman Tick recognized as Mrs. Whiting, who owned the Empire Grill, and according to her father, most everything else in town. Just barely visible through the bare autumn trees, a white limousine idled on the roadway, and it was this that had caught Candace's eye. "Wow," she sighed. "How'd you like to ride in one of those someday?" What Tick noticed, however, was that the woman had noticed them as well. And even though she and Candace were standing close together on a big rock, somehow she was certain that Mrs. Whiting was smiling not at Candace, but at her.
"Slow," Tick decides. Things happen slow. She isn't quite sure why this understanding of the world's movement should be important, but she thinks it is. It could even be the reason that guy Bill Taylor isn't a very good painter. His art happens fast, and he's always talking about how swiftly light changes, about how important it is to attack your painting, to get a record of what you're seeing, because you'll never see that exact thing again. Tick understands what he means, but can't help feeling that the opposite is equally true. Take her parents. At the time, their separation had seemed a bolt from the blue, though now she realizes it had been a slow process, rooted in dissatisfaction and need, in their personalities, really. Maybe the whole thing had come on Tick suddenly, but in reality, her mother's slow march from eye contact to flirtation to infidelity to divorce to remarriage was a Stairmaster journey whose culmination was probably the beginning of another climb that would prove just as slow and inexorable. "And that's the thing," she concludes. "Just because things happen slow doesn't mean you'll be ready for them. If they happened fast, you'd be alert for all kinds of suddenness, aware that speed was trump. Slow works on an altogether different principle, on the deceptive impression that there's plenty of time to prepare, which conceals the central fact that no matter how slow things go, you'll always be slower." The art room has a long bank of windows facing the rear of the school and a huge parking lot that's never filled except during boys' basketball games. This afternoon, only the first 4 or 5 rows of parking spaces are occupied, and from her seat at the blue table, Tick can see straight down a corridor between the 3rd and 4th rows of cars, which means that 8 or 10 drivers have actually respected the yellow lines painted on the blacktop. Beyond the lot is a gentle sloping bank and the oval cinder track her father once told her a funny story about. Beyond that, open field runs to a line of trees where the wetlands begin. Here Tick spots an almost imperceptible movement off in the distance between the rows of cars. What it looks like is a small ball bobbing in a gentle breeze on a placid lake, except there's no water where she's looking. Tick idly watches whatever it is bob up and down and then sideways before returning to her still life, which she completed 2 days ago but still feels is unfinished. She's not sure why. Maybe it's because she can't see how anything so poorly executed could be considered finished. It also bothers her to think that what's wrong with the painting could be the result of a bad decision made early on. Worse, she's not sure whether the bad decision was Mrs. Rodriguez in selecting the ugly peony in the first place or her own. Her decision to paint the peony in its ugliness is defensible, she thinks. But now she realizes that she's painted the surrounding flowers as if they were corrupt by association. If making things seem prettier than they are is a lie, then making them seem uglier must be another. She can tinker with the painting, improve it in small ways, but it won't change the lie at its heart. Only starting over could do that, and it's too late. Next week, they begin a new unit. She steals a look at Candace's painting and is surprised to see that it's not bad.
Up to this point, she'd simply recycle last year's efforts, not a strategy Tick would have recommended, given that Candace took and failed this same class last year on the basis of this very same work. But Mrs. Rodrigue appears to have no memory of any of it, and none of Candace's work so far has received the grade it got the year before. A fact, Tick thinks, Mr. Meyer, the principal, might be interested to learn. That Mrs. Rodrigue's grading corresponds rather chillingly to the income level of her students' parents has, according to her father, already been brought to Mr. Meyer's attention, which might explain why Candace is faring better this year. What impresses Tick most about her friend's effort is that she's accomplished exactly what Mrs. Rodrigue requested, that is, to remember the peony's beauty and paint that memory. In a way, the big, gaudy, pink flower of love is the perfect subject for Candace. Seeing what a good job she's done, Tick at once feels both happy and sad for her friend. Yesterday, on their way home from the river, she and Candace cemented their friendship with a genuine exchange of secrets. Candace, of course, had used Tick as a repository of secrets all term, but this was the first time Tick reciprocated. The secret Candace shared is that she and Justin had sex, which explains why he's been so quiet in class today, and why they exchange shy, scared smiles, full of gratitude and wonder and regret each time he looks up from his work. What Tick told Candace is that she's the one who picked up the X-Acto knife back in September, and that it hadn't been found in all that time because it was tucked snugly in a side pocket of her backpack. Further, she's admitted to Candace that the reason she hasn't returned the knife to the supply closet is that she likes the idea of possessing a weapon, which of course is absurd for a pacifist, as Tick believes herself to be. In truth, every time she takes it out and feels its cool surface, her left arm starts to go numb, and she has to put it away before she becomes ill. The thing to do, she knows, is return it to the supply closet at the end of today's class. But Tick knows she won't, and she knows the reason is that Zach Minty was released from the hospital late this morning. She passed him in the hall between classes and saw the way he looked at her and Candace. For the last 10 minutes, she's been expecting the classroom door to swing open and for Zach to join them at the blue table. Tick can't help anticipating bad things, especially after what happened yesterday between her father and Zach's dad. It's still hard to believe. Her father going to jail. According to Uncle David, that's where he'll end up once he's well enough to be released from the hospital. Zach's dad had wanted to throw him in a cell yesterday when they arrived at the station, but the chief of police had sent them directly to Empire General, where Tick hasn't been allowed to visit him yet. According to her uncle and Charlene, who'd been waiting for her at the house, the lawyer they hired didn't think he'd be locked up for long. There was little doubt he'd be arrested, though, and he'd have to post bail. More than anything, according to Uncle David, her father was embarrassed. He didn't want Tick to see him in his present condition, and he wanted her to know how sorry he was to have botched their trip to Boston on Sunday, though David and Charlene would take her instead. Before she knew it, everything would be back to normal. When Charlene and her uncle rose to leave, it occurred to Tick to ask where her mother was. She delayed coming home in fear of the inevitable scene. After their altercation on Empire Avenue, her mother would be a basket case, swinging back and forth between anger and worry, and Walt would be lurking in the background, making everything worse. The two grown-ups exchanged a clumsy glance that said that this was the very question they'd been hoping she wouldn't ask. "She'll be home soon," Charlene told her. "She's over at the hospital."
"She can visit Daddy and I can't?"
Then they told her that it wasn't her father Janine was visiting, but Walt, who'd been admitted with a concussion and a broken arm. Reluctantly, they explained how this had come to pass. Then another question occurred to her.
"Who's running the restaurant?"
"We closed it for tonight," David admitted. "No way around it. You want to come over with us and eat an enchilada? I got about 150 of them in the oven." And that's what they'd done, the three of them. They'd sat in a corner booth with all the restaurant lights off, silently eating enchiladas and watching cars pull into the parking lot, see the sign on the door, and drive off again. Meanwhile, Tick did a tally in her mind. In one day, her mother had nearly dragged her down Empire Avenue by her backpack. She'd become best friends with Candace Burke. Her father had broken Walt Como's arm in a wrestling match, then gotten into a fight with a policeman and ended up in the hospital, from which he'd be taken directly to jail. And a sign had been posted on the Empire Grill reading, "Closed until further notice." And that wasn't counting the horrible events earlier in the week. But everything would be back to normal before long? "Whatever's bobbing out there," Tick notices, "is still bobbing, but closer now. What it looks like is a human head, though of course that makes no sense." She watches curiously to see whether it will resolve itself as sense or remain nonsense, and she's just about to bet on the latter, an acknowledgement, perhaps, of the irrational world, where people she knows, like her father, become people she doesn't know, where the whole world tilts and solid things become as liquid as objects in a Dali painting, where human heads disassociated from their bodies are borne along on waves of wind-blown grass. When this particular bobbing head resolves itself before her eyes, tilting the world back again, though not completely. Because the head, she realizes, belongs to John Voss. And in fact, it's not bobbing on water or waves of grass, but rather on his shoulders. What she's been observing is the boy's natural loping stride as he approaches the school, crossing the distant field, and then the cinder track, his body hidden below the curvature of the land. Only when he reaches the gentle incline where her father once lost control of Mrs. Whiting's new Lincoln do the boy's neck, shoulders, and torso become visible, a recognizably human form. And then, just as suddenly, he changes course and vanishes entirely behind the rows of cars, gone so completely that Tick wonders if she's imagined him there. The best evidence that what she's seen is real is that her left arm has gone numb. What she realizes when he enters, a 16-year-old boy with a grocery bag folded under his arm, is how relieved she'd been by his disappearance. Though terribly ashamed to feel this, she can't deny it. One look at him now, head down, shoulders hunched forward, resolutely silent, as if he thinks he can walk into art class and take up where he left off, brings back to her the thought she'd tried so hard to ignore last week, which she was too embarrassed to admit, even to her father, that everyone is better off with this boy gone. Not that he is the cause of all this trouble, because she knows he isn't. He's not even really to blame for what happened with his grandmother. In a way, John Voss is like Jesus, blameless, perhaps, but nevertheless the center of all the trouble. If Jesus had gone away, things in Galilee would have returned to normal, just as her father promised they soon would here in Empire Falls. So, as Tick sees John again, and she's the first to because she's been watching the classroom door, waiting for it to open, a wish escapes before she can call it back, that he should disappear again, this time for good. Dead? Is that what she means? She hopes not. No one could want this boy, this child who had dangled from a laundry bag inside a dark closet, not to exist, merely for him not to exist here, because it has proven itself to be the wrong place. She feels like Jesus' disciples must have felt. They never wanted him crucified, of course, but what a relief it must have been when the stone was rolled across the entrance to the tomb, sealing everything shut so they could go back to being fishermen, which they knew how to do, rather than fishers of men, which they didn't. No wonder they didn't recognize him later on the road to Damascus. They didn't want to, any more than Tick wants to welcome this poor boy back into their midst. Except for being blameless, John Voss is not, of course, at all like Jesus. What has he ever been but a silent, sullen, angry burden that no one, including Tick, has wanted to shoulder? Outside of her father, who'd given him a job, and Tick, who'd given him the bare minimum of kindness, the only person who'd showed him any generosity was his grandmother, and he'd repaid that kindness by tossing her lifeless body onto the landfill as if it were a threadbare rug. No, his disappearance has been a blessing, allowing the whole horrible story to recede from public consciousness. True, for the last 5 days, everyone in Dexter County was looking for him, but the truth is, nobody hoped to find him. Is there a term for that, Tick wonders? The thing everyone is searching for and hoping not to find? The thing you're secretly glad has made a clean getaway, lest you yourself be blamed should it ever be located? John Voss moves deliberately across the room to the blue table and stops just a few feet from Tick, no doubt confronting the fact that there's no place for him to sit. In fact, starting the day after his disappearance, there'd been one less chair at this table, representing, Tick realizes, everyone's secret wish. Mrs. Rodriguez, she notes, has risen from behind her desk and actually seems to be contemplating a journey across the room. Everyone else is just staring, dumbfounded. Without looking at anyone, John sets his folded grocery bag down on the table with a dull thud. Now that he's close, Tick can smell him. It's the same rancid smell he'd had back in September before he started working at the restaurant. His clothes are wet and caked with dirt, his hair knotted with bits of leaves and twigs. The room is silent. Tick can feel nothing on the left side of her body. She reaches down to her backpack, where in one of the side pockets there is, in addition to the X-Acto knife, the extra sandwich she's brought along every day this week, in case the boys showed up. Justin Dibble is the first to speak. "Hey, John," he says, as if this were a normal day, just another class. "What's in the bag?" At first he doesn't appear to hear. When he finally reaches into the bag and takes out the revolver, it seems to Tick that he may have done so in response not to Justin, but to a voice in his own head. The revolver looks like an antique, or maybe a stage prop, with its wooden grip and long barrel. He points it and pulls the trigger without hesitation, and then Justin Dibble vanishes in the roar. He simply isn't sitting there anymore. Mrs. Rodriguez, halfway across the room, stops next to the vase of still-life flowers, unable to move forward or back or even to scream, and before the echo of the first explosion dies, there are two more, and Mrs. Rodriguez drops to her knees, a large peony blooming on her bosom, the vase tumbling off the table and shattering on the floor.
"Oh my God! Oh my God!"
Candace whimpers, and Tick reaches out to the boy just before the fourth deafening shot. She isn't sure if she has actually touched him, but apparently she has, because John Voss slowly turns to look at her. Both of them are standing now, though she cannot remember rising to her feet. Behind her, she hears or imagines hearing the classroom door open and other kids running out, something she wishes her own legs would allow her to do. She can feel her vision narrowing the way it does when she's about to lose consciousness. She looks over at where Candace was sitting, but the girl is no longer there, and she hopes this means that she has either fled or ducked under the table. She wants for Candace not to be harmed, now that they're friends. It occurs to Tick that Zach Minty's stupid game has prepared her for this moment. She faces John Voss as bravely as she can, knowing it will all be over soon. Her vision has now narrowed to the point where she can barely make him out, his face bloody, his eyes almost sad. When he speaks, his voice comes from a long way off.
"This is what I dream,"
he tells her, in answer to the question she asked him so long ago. Then he squeezes the trigger, and she hears what she is certain will be the last sound she will ever hear, and feels herself thrust backward into blackness. Chapter 31. Across town, Miles Roby was sitting at the edge of the hospital bed, compiling a mental list of all the people to whom he owed an apology, when one of them, his former mother-in-law, walked in, sat down in a chair just inside the door, and burst out laughing. Miles studied B through his good eye, the other still fused shut with mucus and blood and swelling. Finally, she stopped and caught her breath.
I'm sorry, Miles, she sighed. I'm not laughing at you.
As lies went, this one seemed particularly feeble to a man dressed in a hospital gown so threadbare it verged on transparency. He had a room designed for two all to himself, so it wasn't like there was anybody else for his former mother-in-law to be laughing at. At first, the other bed had been occupied by none other than Jimmy Minty, causing Miles to wonder if some sort of perverse hospital policy required men who'd beaten each other up to share lodgings afterward. Actually, it was more Jimmy Minty who'd beaten Miles up, which was why the policeman had been released, and Miles, with bruised kidneys and a cracked rib, two broken teeth and blood in his urine, was left behind, still groggy with medication, to be laughed at by visitors. He'd had half a dozen between last night and this morning, though the visits were a little hazy, thanks to the painkillers the night before. David and Charlene had been to see him, of course, and Father Mark had brought the news that it was at last official. Sacré-Cœur and St. Catherine's would become one parish. He himself was awaiting reassignment. He didn't know where. Someplace even colder and farther north, he was guessing. Even Janine had stopped in briefly. It was just like him, she said, to finally go and do something interesting after she divorced him. She also asked if he realized that with his two broken teeth, he was beginning to look like Max. At least she'd kept Tick away, for which he was grateful. An hour ago, he'd asked the nurse for another of the yummy painkillers he'd been given last night, but she'd smiled and said, "Oh no, I don't think so," as if she knew perfectly well that he'd been a very bad boy to enjoy it so much. By way of compensation, she provided him with two entirely inferior Tylenol 3s, but his head still felt like a yo-yo suspended on the end of a malicious child's string. A few minutes before B entered the room in a gale of laughter, three ambulances housed in the garage directly below his room, a design flaw surely, screamed out of the hospital en route to God knew where, their sirens loud enough to explode his head, all of which, he knew, was pretty much what he deserved. "I just stuck my head in down the hall," B finally explained. "You should see the goddamn rooster." Walt Como's name was near the top of the list of people Miles owed apologies to, of course, and the reason he was sitting on the edge of the bed rather than lying down was that he'd been contemplating whether, if he took it slow, maybe with the aid of the walker he'd used earlier to go to the bathroom, he might be able to make it down the hall to where David and Charlene had told him the silver fox was convalescing. Miles thought it might cheer Walt to view the sorry condition of the man who'd broken his arm and given him a concussion. On the other hand, why undertake such an arduous journey to apologize to one person when there was another candidate right there in front of you? "B," Miles said, hanging his head, "I can't even begin to tell you how sorry I am." "Now, B," she said, "he had it coming." "Not that," Miles assured her. His voice had a strange echo inside his head, like an overseas call being bounced off a satellite. "The tavern. I should have seen it coming. What she'd do, I mean." B took his hand then, studying his still swollen fingers. "Speaking of the bar, I got an offer on the place this morning." She looked up at him. "You don't seem that surprised." "Mrs. Whiting?" She shrugged. "It came from a law firm in Boston by way of a local realtor, but yeah, that would be my guess." "Good deal?" "Probably 30 or 40 grand more than it's worth." "You should take it." "I know. Maybe I will." She looked him in the eye long and hard. "Do." She nodded. "Still, I'm thinking, fuck her." Now there was something going on out in the hall. First shouting, and then a doctor, two nurses, and an orderly went by at a dead run. "I'm not sure F. Lee Bailey could win a pitched battle against that woman," Miles said, feeling a terrible exhaustion set in at the thought of her. "Not in Dexter County, anyway." "How do you know?" B said. "It's been 20 years since anybody tried." "For good reason." B got to her feet then, clearly disappointed. "Well..." I better go before I tire you out. Just tell me one thing, though. Wouldn't you rather go out in a blaze of glory? He couldn't help but smile. Look at me, Bee, he said, though she already was. I just did. When she was gone, Miles went over to the window and stood there, looking across the parking lot and through a line of bare trees to where the gray river flowed. He'd had one other visitor, last night sometime. He couldn't remember exactly when, maybe early this morning. He drifted off into a narcotic sleep and awakened with a start to find Cindy Whiting sitting at his bedside. Her appearance had stunned him almost as much as her presence. She looked, Miles couldn't help thinking, astonishingly like her mother, or rather the way Miles imagined Mrs. Whiting might look after a long illness. Assuming there existed a virus with the temerity to use her for a host, it was hard to tell how much weight Cindy had lost since the football game. What, 3 weeks ago? Her face was pale and gaunt, the flesh along her upper arm sagging.
You're awake, she said. How long have you been here?
A while, she admitted. Do you know what I was just thinking about? How strange it is that you and I happen to be born on the same day in this very hospital.
Almost the same hour.
For a long time, I thought of it as a sign that we were meant to be together. And that almost happened, didn't it, Miles?
When he didn't respond, she continued.
Do you remember the time we kissed?
He did. It had been an impulse born of confusion, but still impossible to either call back or erase from memory. God knew over the years he'd tried. It had happened the night before Grace, in the final stages of her illness, was moved from the Whiting home to the hospital, where she would live another 48 hours, most of them in a coma. June was hot that year, and at Grace's insistence, Max had taken David to the coast with him 2 weeks before, ostensibly to help on the house painting crew, but in fact, so he wouldn't have to watch his mother die. Roger Sperry's illness had already killed him, and Miles, who'd been home since the previous October, was working long hours at the Empire Grill. He was grateful for the distraction and lengthened the hours whenever possible, though he was ashamed of himself for leaving school to be with his dying mother, only to hide out at the restaurant, no more prepared at 21 to watch his mother die than David was at 12. What little strength Grace had left, she used to express her anger. It was rage, really, about his decision to leave St. Luke's. Even though the academic year was finished, he'd driven down for Peter and Dawn's graduation the month before, and though it was pointless for her to be angry over something that no longer pertained, Grace, in her confusion and pain, clung to her anger as if that alone might keep her alive.
Didn't he realize, she kept asking, that the mere sight of him only increased her suffering? As her condition worsened, he delayed his visits as much as possible, often arriving at the Whiting house at a time when, according to the rhythms of her illness, she was likely to be asleep or heavily sedated with morphine. It was Cindy Whiting, having returned to Empire Falls herself from Augusta, who had been his mother's constant nurse and companion. Miles often found her crying quietly at Grace's bedside when he arrived after closing the restaurant. On the night Cindy was now recalling, his mother was awake when he appeared, and upon seeing him in the doorway, she'd simply turned her head and looked away, a gesture so eloquent in its futility that it had backed him out into the hall. Cindy had risen to follow him, leaning heavily on her cane in order to close the door quietly behind her. Her eyes were swollen with her own suffering, and it hadn't seemed so wrong for him to take her in his arms. When she raised her head to his, they'd kissed, and where was the harm in a kiss so full of need? He should have broken it off, of course, but he hadn't, the moment proceeding recklessly until he slid his hand up under her sweater, then under her brassiere, cupping her breast, feeling her shudder against him. They'd remain like that until there was a moan of pain from inside the room, and Cindy whispered, "I'll be right back," and returned to his mother's bedside. Poor, crippled girl. She could do nothing quickly, however. And by the time she returned, he was gone. "Yes, I remember," he told her, blinking at the memory. Then she said something that surprised him. "You do know I've had lovers, don't you, Miles?" "I'm glad, Cindy," he said, feeling himself redden with embarrassment because, no, he hadn't suspected this. "I wanted you to know because I'm leaving tomorrow. The truth is I don't do very well at home. I never have. There's a man in Augusta who cares for me, and I like him well enough. It's not a wonderful life, but I can see clearly there, and it's important for me to see things clearly. I want you to know about this man because you always imagine me unhappy, and that hurts my feelings. It's like you decided a long time ago that someone like me is incapable of joy. It hurts you to think that my life is a misery, so you don't think of me at all. You don't call me to find out how I'm doing because you think you already know. It doesn't occur to you that I might be happy, that I might like to share it with you." "I'm sorry, Cindy." When it was clear he was unable to choke out any more than this, she said, "Is it so terrible for you to know I'll always love you?" "No, of course not. It's just that I've been such a poor friend to you, Cindy, right from the start. It's true, you always managed to hurt my feelings worse than all the others, but that was only because I had feelings for you. You never meant to hurt me, not ever, I know that." She got to her feet then. "Remember how you used to try to get me to understand poems?" He nodded. "Actually, I understood a lot more than you thought. It was just so much fun watching how frustrated you'd get." "Thanks a lot. I'm more like my mother than you know." "No one's like your mother." At the door, she stopped, then turned back to regard him. "She's not finished with you, Miles," she said. He nodded. "I know." It took him a while, but he managed to dress, not wanting to traverse the corridor, which was strangely deserted, in his hospital gown. The door at the near end of the hall had just slammed shut, and the sound of people running and shouting still echoed in the stairwell. The nurse's station was abandoned, and somewhere nearby a two-way radio barked loudly, but with too much static for the words to be comprehensible. He'd made it about halfway down the corridor when the double doors at the end swung open, and Bill Dawes, the chief of police, looking pale, stepped through them.
"I was down in radiology when the call came in, Miles," he said.
This explained why a man who was usually so meticulous about his appearance now stood before him with his shirt only half tucked in.
"You better come with me," he added.
Miles would recall many of the details only later. Over long weeks and months, they returned the way flashes of lightning illuminate a nocturnal landscape, eventually coming together to form a narrative. The boy, John Voss, statue-like, his face bloody, locked alone and unattended in the back seat of the police cruiser. Then inside, the modular addition that housed the art and shop classes, much of the horror visible from the doorway. In the studio itself, a small, empty wooden table in the center of the room, at the base of which Doris Rodrigue was sprawled, face down, her legs splayed, her forehead resting in a puddle of water and broken glass. Under a nearby table, the body of a boy Miles recognized from the grill, part of Zach Minty's crowd, with a gaping wound in the head. And finally, slumped up against the wall near the door, one hand resting on his stomach, and looking as if he were stricken by a severe attack of dyspepsia, the body of Otto Meyer Jr. Miles took in, really took in, none of this at the time, any more than he'd registered the crowd of students outside, some dazed, others crying, interspersed with shell-shocked teachers. Bill Dawes had been waved through a blockade hastily set up at the street entrance to the school, but already the first frantic parents were arriving, abandoning their cars in driveways, on lawns, in the middle of the road, anywhere, and then running through backyards and across the school grounds from all directions. Heavy, middle-aged women, many of them, some slipping and falling in the wet grass, then grunting back onto their feet again and moving forward, almost completely blinded by tears and a fear the likes of which they'd never known, never even imagined. Miles both saw and did not see any of this, nor did he really see any of the living once he and Bill Dawes entered the room where Justin Dibble and Doris Rodrigue and Otto Meyer Jr. lay dead. Several policemen and county officials were conversing quietly, as if they had no wish to be overheard by one another or the deceased. Jimmy Minty was among them, too, with two black eyes and a metal protective plate over his nose, trying to talk to his son, who kept turning away and finally pushing his father hard with both hands, one of which was wrapped in a bloody bandage. Miles was only vaguely aware of the officer who grabbed his elbow to keep him from tromping through the blood and glass and water, or of Bill Dawes's guiding hand on his shoulder, amazingly strong, he would marvel later, for a man so ill. It was Bill who finally asked, his voice filling the room, this man who would himself be dead by Christmas, "Where is this man's daughter?" In the tormented aftermath, what Miles found hardest to forgive himself for was the fact that when they'd entered the room, he walked right past her. She was huddled in the corner, behind the classroom door, he kept reminding himself, trying to be rational about it, though his guilt was too profound to admit reason. He had walked right past her. Wasn't there something in a father, he asked himself, some extra sense that should have told him right where she'd be? Wasn't she his only daughter? A better father would have been able to find her blindfolded, in the dark, attracted by the invisible beacon of her suffering. How long did he stand there in that room, his back to her, as if to suggest to this beloved girl that the rest of them were the important ones? This thought would wake him in the middle of the night for months, long after he'd come to terms with the other horrors. The young policeman stationed at the door, the same one who'd given Miles a hard time back in September in front of his childhood home, was the one who tapped his chief on the shoulder and said, "Here, sir." He seemed to notice Miles only once he'd taken a step toward his daughter, urging him, "Be careful." The girl in the corner didn't look much like Tick, though of course he knew it was. Her expression was one he'd neither seen before nor imagined she was capable of forging. At first he didn't realize what she was clutching to her chest. The X-Acto knife held tightly with both hands, as if its blade were 3 feet long. And when Miles, perhaps not immediately recognizable with one eye swollen shut and two broken teeth, offered that first movement toward her, his daughter made a flicking motion with the knife, warning him away, and from her throat came a gargling hiss. Sinking to his knees before her, he said, "Tick!" His own voice sounding only slightly less strange than hers, the stern voice he rarely used, only when he really wanted her attention. He wasn't sure it was the right tone or that kneeling there saying her name again and again was the right thing to do, because he had no idea how far into herself she'd withdrawn. He wouldn't remember later how many times he called to her before her eyes flickered, or how many more before they came into something like focus, and she saw him for who he was. In that instant, she was suddenly back, and her expression first relaxed, then came apart, and she was sobbing, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy!" As if she had no idea how far away he might be, or else, wherever she'd just been, she'd been counting the number of times he'd spoken her name, and was now counting them back to him. David Roby would wonder later how a man in his brother's condition was able to do what he did, to gather up his daughter into his arms and in that none-too-gentle bear hug of his, carry her out the door and away. Later, Miles himself would remember Jimmy Minty's comment as they were leaving, "We gonna let him just walk out of here?" And Bill Dawes's response, "You tend to your own kid, Jimmy. Let's all just tend to our own kids, okay?"
Chapter 32. In early April, it turned warm, and Miles could see from the weather map in the newspaper that the unseasonable temperatures extended all the way up into Maine, which had endured a particularly brutal winter, one nor'easter after another, dropping a foot of new snow every week. He'd spoken to his brother after the last of these, and David reported that as of April Fool's Day, half the residents of Empire Falls still had little red flags attached to their car antennas so they could be seen as they backed out of their driveways between towering snowbanks. The town's budget for snow removal had been exhausted in late January.
"Business will pick up soon," David added.
It had been slow most of the winter, partly due to the weather, partly because after the Empire Grill closed, a lot of their customers, especially those from the college in Fairhaven, were slow to follow them to Bee's Tavern, despite the ads they'd finally taken out in the school paper.
"We could use you, sooner than later."
"Sorry," Miles told him. "I don't think so."
"How's Tick?" his brother asked, both men aware that this hadn't really changed the subject.
"Good," Miles told him. "Better every day."
"She doesn't want to come home?"
The truth was she did. Just last week she'd asked if they could visit during Vineyard High's spring break, and had she claimed to miss her mother, Miles might have given in. But what she had in mind was to visit Candace, who remained hospitalized, and John Voss, who only last month was declared incompetent to stand trial and remanded to the state mental hospital in Augusta. Miles wasn't sure that either of these visits was a good idea just yet. In the months since the shooting, Tick had come to terms with the broad outline of what had happened that last afternoon. That John Voss had shot and killed Justin Dibble and Doris Rodrigue, that he'd also shot Candace Burke in the neck, the bullet nearly severing her spine. She understood, too, that he'd then turned on Tick and would have shot her, too, if Otto Meyer Jr. hadn't stepped between them. She even knew that the boy had then turned the gun on himself and pulled the trigger several times, but that only one bullet remained in the chamber, a bullet as old as the gun itself, his long-dead grandfather's service revolver, and it had not fired. This much Tick understood, but what Miles didn't know was how much of this understanding was reinforced by memory. Though she'd had terrible nightmares for nearly 2 months, she wouldn't talk about them, so he didn't know if it was remembered horror she was experiencing or dream analogies. Over time, he told her what he thought was important for her to know. He told her that Candace was alive as soon as he heard this news from his brother, and much later, he told her about Otto, who once had lunged from the back seat of the car to save the baseball team from Miles's inexperience at the wheel, and who had now saved Tick's life at the cost of his own.